From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, the controversy over raw milk. It's legal to sell, yet often impossible to find. Has bacon finally jumped the shark? Lard is back in vogue, and it's not just for baking pies. Plus, forget everything you thought you knew about fortified wine. We'll get a lesson in the not-so-sweet varieties later on in the show. But first, as we do every week, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We love to celebrate summer fruit when it finally arrives at the farmers market. And what better way than to talk to a chef about what they're going to be doing with the variety that we have. And David Lefevre is the executive chef at MB Post down in Manhattan Beach. And David is as excited as the rest of us about all the fabulous summer fruit we have. David, talk to us about what kind of fruit you're using and how you're preparing it down there at MB Post.
Well, right now, I mean, cherries are just popping out right now. They're sweet and tart. But one thing that we're really excited about are apricots, peaches, white peaches, nectarines. Stone fruit is really coming out. Last week and the week before, it was still a little bit early, but right now it's really sweet. And we're looking at using that in a couple different ways. The like Frog Hollow apricots, they're great. We're taking them, just lightly stewing them and serving those with our cheese courses. Looking at white peaches right now and roasting white peaches with some cornbread and whipped ricotta and a little spiced honey. We make our own whipped ricotta at house. So just really taking the simplicity of the fruit and just highlighting it with a little bit of vanilla or highlighting with a little rosemary, but trying to do the least amount possible of the fruit because it's just killer right now.
When you roast the fruit, are you grilling it? Are you putting it in the oven, or how are you doing that?
Well, you can do both. You know, if you're going to grill it, all you need to do is cut it, pit it, and lightly season it and oil it and get really nice marks on it, nice high heat. And if you're going to be roasting it, same thing. You want, you know, what we would do is we'd expose the flesh, take the pit out, a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of herb, and then just we always do high heat to try and make sure that we're not mushing the fruit.
Right. And when you put that grilled peach on top of that cornbread with that mascarpone, how does that all go together?
Well, you know, what we like to do, we're trying the dish right now, and we're roasting the peach ahead of time, and then we're taking a hot skillet and we're pouring the cornbread and corn mixture into the skillet hot, and then we're placing the roasted peaches on top of it and then putting it in the oven. And so what'll happen is you'll get even more color on the top of the peach as the bread kind of bakes into it, almost like a tartatin style. Mm-hmm. And then just taking the, you know, we get goat milk at the restaurant, we make our own ricotta, and then we just simply whip that ricotta, fold in a little bit of herb, put a canela on top, and then drizzle a little bit of spiced honey that we make.
Oh, that sounds so good. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you. Bye.
That was David Lefevre, clearly excited that summer is here and the cherries and the apricots are in. And he's the executive chef at Manhattan Beach Post down in Manhattan Beach. One of the other great seasonal varieties we have here is the wild mushrooms that are brought down to us by David West of Clearwater Farm. And this is porcini season. Everybody's running around talking about porcinis. Let's talk about those, and let's also talk about the very brief and sporadic morel season we've been having. So, David, just briefly, let's talk about the morels, and then let's talk about those porcinis.
All right. They're both spring mushrooms, starting as early as mid to late April and usually going till about the 4th of July. This year, no sooner did the morel season start did we get hit with a rather odd and localized heat wave in Northern California. And that heat brought on a wonderful early and large porcini flush, but it also wiped out the morels. They are coming in very sporadically. I usually sell out in the first half hour of the market. I don't have more than a couple of pounds at a time. Now, there's some higher elevation areas that haven't started, and we're still hoping for a decent morel crop. But the good news is the weather that was bad for the morels was awesome for the porcini. So we have everything from, like, the big soft stuff, great for risotto or grilling. If you really love those grilled porcini you had in Italy, it's typically the larger, softer stuff. If you love those very sweet, buttery seps you had in France, that's the smaller, hard stuff.
And let's describe the shape of the porcini mushroom.
You know, porcini gets its, in Italy it's porcini, in France it's seps, in Germany it's steinpilz. The steinpilz and the porcini, I think, best describe it. Of course, my French isn't very good, so I don't really know what sep means. But porcini is little pig, and they look like little hunched over like little brown, like the backs of a little tiny piglet. And Steinpilz is stone mushroom. And the best of the porcini, the youngest, the firmest, are literally rock hard. They're as hard as an apple or a potato. It's unbelievable. And those, you just shave them raw. Just shave them like it was a truffle over a little baby arugula or the wild arugula. Drizzle a little good olive oil, some salt on it. I don't use any acid, no lemon, no vinegar. Maybe some good Parmesan, and that's it. And just devour it.
So how long will we have these wonderful porcinis?
Yeah, that's the bad news. We started early. We're going gangbusters. I imagine that's going to lead to a rather abbreviated season. Hopefully we'll get through till the end of June. I'm sure we'll get through till Father's Day. Beyond the third week in June, I don't know. I'm crossing my fingers.
All right. So exciting. Mushrooms are here. And David, we'll catch up with you later and talk about the as the seasons progress, as we do with the rest of the farmers. That was David West, and he is the wild mushroom purveyor here at the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica markets, talking, just celebrating porcinis. Starting on Wednesday, June 6th, for the rest of the summer, we will be introducing another grass-fed, grass-finished beef vendor. These are California closed herds. Hopefully more cuts and more selection, more variety, so more people will be experimenting and tasting this wonderful product. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Hear David Lefevre explain his method for grilling fruit in an outtake on the Good Food blog. Like the music you hear on Good Food, then you'll probably really love our Music to Cook By playlist on the Good Food blog. Our music supervisor, Gary Masiha, selects a new song each week. This one is by The Specials. One thing you'll find at the Santa Monica Farmers Market is raw milk. Well, usually you'll see raw milk, but last month, raw milk customers showed up at the market and their go-to raw dairy, Organic Pastures, wasn't there. It was the second of two recalls in the past 8 months that have crippled the company's business and left raw milk drinkers empty-handed. Raw milk is, in fact, legal to sell in California, but when undercover agents from three federal agencies raided Rawsome in Venice, California in 2010 and then again in 2011, it looked and felt remarkably like a drug bust. You may recall Stephen Colbert's classic coverage of the event.
All around the nation, real Americans are standing up to the big government elites who think they know best.
This is America, and the ruling class elites may try, but they will never have the last word on liberty.
There is only one kind of freedom, and that's individual liberty. Government is the enemy of liberty.
But liberty is under siege here in Venice, California, home to Rawsome Foods, a raw food co-op. Rawsome member James Stewart explains the complex etymology of the co-op's name.
The word awesome with an R in front of it.
But everything isn't so rawsome. On the morning of June 30th, armed government agents swarmed into this private business and carried out a blitzkrieg raid. These terrified rawsome members will never forget where they were when the went down.
I was in Minnesota.
Okay, that doesn't help. Anyone else want to tell us what happened?
They drew their guns, acting as if there was some seriously dangerous activity going on here.
They asked everybody that was here to line up on the back gate, and they frisked everybody.
And why did the government thugs raid Rawsome? To seize their raw milk.
It does seem ridiculous, but not everyone's laughing. Some raw milk enthusiasts equate the vigilance of law enforcement to that of a witch hunt against raw dairy producers and sellers. And others wonder, what's the big deal? Here to sort through the mess is Dana Goodyear. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, where her article Raw Deal recently appeared.
Raw milk is legal in California if you meet certain very, very stringent conditions. And it's very hard and very expensive to meet those conditions as a dairy. There are two legal dairies in California. One is Clairvelle and one is Organic Pastures. And I visited Organic Pastures. Mark McAfee, who is the owner of that and dairyman there, is a very vocal figure in the raw milk movement. He's enthusiastic and infectious with his enthusiasm. And so he's often a spokesperson for it. His dairy is huge. There are about 430 cows on some 500 acres. They are mostly on pasture, which is something that people who drink raw milk value, that the animals not be in sort of confinement-type operations. And he's got a great burden to meet these regulatory standards that are really quite high. The microbial counts have to be the same as milk after pasteurization. So as he says, it's almost impossible to do this, and it's incredibly expensive. So the air of secrecy comes from the fact that not everyone who wants to drink raw milk in California has access to organic pastures, and not everybody who wants to drink raw milk in California wants milk that's coming from a large dairy like that. A lot of people prefer something where they're going to a farmer near them or a farmer they know or feel they know and getting, you know, milk from a couple of cows that they partially own in this herd share kind of arrangement. The legality of that herd share arrangement is yet to be seen.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about just some of the characters that are in this sort of raw milk, more clandestine movement. Because you did mention that a lot of people get their milk from sources other than the two certified dairies. Mm-hmm. So who's the dairy fairy? And
I cannot say.
I know. What is the dairy fairy?
What is the dairy fairy? The dairy fairy, she is somebody who was part of the Rossum world, and she wanted to continue to provide access to milk. And part of the drive for that comes from, well, she wanted that stuff too. But there's a community of people who drink raw milk because they believe that it is forestalling progression of a disease. I mean, that's a big part of this is the really ill people who, you know, cancer patients and people with other diseases who feel that this is going to, that this is keeping them healthy. So there's an urgency there. It's not just a flavor thing for a lot of people, but there are a lot of people who build their lives around this kind of eating, and it's integral to how they get through every day. So this is basically a milk truck that comes to an undisclosed location, and you have to be part of this network, and you have to be trusted within this network to get the location, and you place your order with the dairy fairy a little bit in advance, and you go to the designated spot, and you write your check, or you give your cash, and you get your box full of raw goat milk, raw goat yogurt, raw cow milk, of course, cow colostrum, homespun kind of labels. Other things are for sale there. It ends up feeling a little bit like a kind of like a fairy market. You know, I heard people who are sort of very tied into the Rossum community approach the dairy fairy and say, you know, I know somebody. I've been picking up stuff for her. She's been placing her order through me. I totally trust her. Can we add her? So it's, you know, there's a vetting process for who gets to come into this world. And there's a lot of paranoia, especially among the Rossum crowd because of what happened. So, you know, everybody's afraid that they could get arrested too. Although I should say it's not illegal to consume raw milk anywhere in the country.
It's the sale.
The sale is what is problematic. And, you know, if you're taking milk across state lines, that is a federal crime.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to New Yorker writer Dana Goodyear about the raw milk industry. She told me that regulation over raw dairy products in Europe is less arbitrary than it is here in the U.S.
Here we have, you know, it's state by state, and there are a number of states where it's totally illegal to sell raw milk. And there are a number of states where it's legal only if you get it from the farm. And there are other states where it's legal for retail sale, like California. And there are other states where it's legal only to sell it as pet food. So we have this patchwork. And we also have such a strong legacy in this country of trying to eradicate raw milk. And that legacy doesn't exist in the same way in Europe.
Talk a little bit about the history of that legacy. Why? How did it start?
Well, all milk used to be raw milk. And then in about the 1830s was when this shift in society started to really become notable, which is, you know, with urbanization, women working and not breastfeeding as much, needing milk for young children and or infants, and the rise of that, all these things contributed to the rise of something called swill dairies, which were dairies that were set up next to distilleries, and these whiskey distilleries were also a new phenomenon in the United States. The cows were fed on the spent grains from the distilleries, which was not a very nutritious meal for them. It boosted their milk production initially, and then it sickened them, basically. But the conditions the cows lived in were just appalling, and the milk that the cows produced was full of tuberculosis and other kinds of harmful diseases and bacteria. So the infant mortality rate was incredibly high. And that we also, you know, didn't treat the water. So, I mean, there were other factors. It wasn't just the milk, but there was a huge campaign mounted to fix the milk problem. And there was no distinction made between raw milk that was produced that way and raw milk that was produced in a way that would potentially be healthful. And so once Pasteur came up with his formula for heat treating, it was applied to milk, and there were some very strong advocates for applying this to all milk. Nathan Strauss, who was a rich philanthropist in New York, was probably the most famous. And there was a simultaneous and parallel movement for certified raw milk, which is to say, okay, let's not take the contaminated milk and clean it through pasteurization. Let's just make the whole process clean. That died out. You know, pasteurization won. And you can't argue with it. It works. It is incredibly efficient. It's not perfect. We know that there are problems that, you know, bacteria can enter milk once it's been pasteurized and kill people. But that's what you're fighting against in this country, is this idea that the pasteurization works. Why would you choose an alternative that's riskier? This is what the regulator's point of view. We fixed this problem. Why are you trying to unfix this problem?
So we're at this point now where it's like very polarized, and it must be very difficult for each side to try and have an actual conversation to come to some way to develop a more sane, less arbitrary set of rules that would benefit everyone. So at this point, who's winning the war? Do you foresee a future at all for raw milk?
I do. I think that there's so much desire. There's so much consumer desire, and some, you know, so it is fueled by the prohibition on it. I mean, the desire intensifies when, you know, the word no makes you want it more. I think that that is a growing movement. I think raw milk drinkers are on the rise. I don't think that the regulatory opposition to raw milk is going away either. I think that the more passion there is for this product, the more these regulatory bodies are going to try to stamp it out. Although I should say that in California, there is the California Department of Food and Agriculture has assembled a working group to study small herd dairies, which encompasses the idea of herd shares. So, you know, and California is very progressive in food law. So there is some thinking here that, you know, maybe we need to account for the fact that these small farmers can't afford to be certified in the way that we've asked them to be certified. And if we know they're selling raw milk, let's try to make the raw milk safe.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Thank you very much.
Dana Goodyear is a staff writer for The New Yorker. We've been talking about her recent article, Raw Deal, which looks at the raw milk industry in California. And you can watch Stephen Colbert's complete coverage of the raw milk raid at Rossum on the Good Food blog. Up next, Jonathan Gold wonders, has bacon finally jumped the shark? That's next after this short break.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. It's that time of the show when Jonathan Gold comes by. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and he tells us each week where to go pick up our forks. This week, we're headed to a new restaurant in Silver Lake, where the menu is all about the meat.
There's a restaurant I've been going to a lot lately that I really like called Black Hog. 2 G's on the hog, thank you very much.
And who's behind Black Hog?
There's a chef named Eric Park, who's a local guy who's cooked at some pretty impressive restaurants in New York, including 11 Madison Park. He got some ribbing from that in the kitchen, I bet. And most notably, I think, at Spotted Pig under April Bloomfield. And so you know if he's worked at Spotted Pig and he has a restaurant named Black Hog, you know exactly what you're going to be finding a whole lot of in this restaurant.
So Black Hog with two G's and a picture of a little lamb, I would venture to guess that Black Hog is a variety of sheep.
You're right. It's a black sheep that sort of always stands out from the herd, I think.
Oh, I like that.
And because it's a black hog, you would expect it to be a pig restaurant. But in fact, one of the things that they have is a lamb burger with blue cheese and onions pickled with habanero chilies. But in case you're getting the wrong idea, they have plenty of pig on the menu. And probably the dish that people are talking about the most is something that they call popcorn bacon.
Yeah, that's what my eyes first went to when I looked at the menu.
Popcorn bacon may be, I hate to use the phrase, where bacon has jumped the shark. Because as much as we all love bacon, and as much as we all love popcorn chicken or popcorn crawfish or popcorn shrimp, the idea of battered lardons that are then deep fried and served with a cream to dip it with is that one step past which bacon must not go.
Yeah, I think you have to be very young with a very long sense of longevity ahead of you to really embrace that dish.
Don't get me wrong. Popcorn bacon is really good. Really good. But it's a dish that signals the demise of our species.
Did you have the spicy chicken liver on toast with chicken cracklins?
Of course I did. What do you take me for?
That sounds really good.
It was. It was more probably creamy than livery, but it was good. They had something I'd never even contemplated before, which was fried olives, you know, with the pit still in them, that were served with goat cheese that had been whipped with honey, so it was still thick. And you wouldn't think that the combination of that would be a good one, but it was completely delicious. There are roast Brussels sprouts there. Every place has Brussels sprouts. It's a law that you have to have Brussels sprouts on your menu now. What have we been doing without Brussels sprouts all these years, after all? And it comes with anchovy and a little bit of citrus, and they're nice. There are oysters that are served with like a pickle juice mignonette.
Now, mignonette is the
it's like the little vinegar sauce that comes with oysters sometimes. I mean, I just eat an oyster as an oyster. I don't even bother with the lemon, much less the vinegar. But if you were going to bother with the vinegar thing, maybe you go to the pickle juice. And down through the line, there are marrow bones, just roast marrow bones, regular ones, served with radishes. Again, there must be some sort of marrow bone regulation on the books. Your suggestion that it's the new foie gras is probably correct. There are sautéed wild mushrooms, which come in something they call the brioche box, which is I guess it's brioche, like carved out in the way that you would carve out a book in order to like hide your valuables, except instead of your valuables, you have sautéed mushrooms, and it's tasty. Then you're done with dinner, or you know, maybe you'll have a burger, or maybe you'll have a chicken under a brick. But then you come to their dessert, of which they are extremely proud, as they probably should be, which are the churros, hot churros, four hot, fluted, wonderful churros that are rolled in sugar spice to resemble chai and served with a walnut oil cream to dip them in.
I might have to have that first instead of the popcorn bacon.
I wonder if they did popcorn churros. A boy can dream.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Black Hog with two G's on Sunset Boulevard between Western and Normandy. You can get a text message really easily, including the restaurant's address and Jonathan's favorite dishes, by just texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions conveniently located on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on our Good Food blog. When was the last time you went to a restaurant and you actually ordered a sherry? Or maybe Madeira? When was the last time a sommelier even suggested one? Probably never, right? Well, Maxwell Lear is trying to change all that. He's a Southern California wine steward, and his latest project is Wine to Vines. His advice on fortified wine in the LA Times inspired us to learn more. So I guess we should start with a definition. What is fortified wine?
Fortified wine is a category of wine, which basically means wine subject to fortification or the addition of alcohol past what's produced by the grape must or sugar originally.
And what is the traditional way of fortification?
Well, every warm wine region has a tradition of fortified wine, typically modeled in the fashion of port and sherry. But, you know, there's a whole variety of wines, vermouth, Madeira, sherry, port, Banyuls, Marsala. Every area fashions differently their interpretation of fortified wines.
Now, why is it particularly warm countries?
Because of the hot climate. It's about the cultivation of fruit and basically getting out of the grape what you can coax from the local climate. And it just so happens that warmer climates are better suited to producing fortified wines. And, you know, here in Los Angeles, we have a fortified wine named after the city. It's called Angelica. And it was what the Franciscan missionaries first started to make when they arrived in Southern California. It was one of the first wines made in the state. And they made it from cuttings of the Mission grape. Which is also known as Palomino Fino, the main grape for making sherry in Andalusia. So, you know, there's this tradition even here in Southern California, in Los Angeles, of making fortified wines.
Okay, so now let's talk about what it tastes like. When I think of fortified wine, I think of ports and sherries, but not so much dry. I tend to think of sweetness and
right.
A texture that's maybe a little more syrupy. Is it always like that?
I think that the conventional wisdom has assigned fortified wine to the stickies category, and that's perhaps a bit unfortunate because fortified wines come in all shapes and sizes, as do most genres of wine. You have those that are very clean and clear and bright and dry, and those that are deep, dark, and again, more unctuous, perhaps more long-lasting on the palate. But the way that fortified wine is made is you introduce a grape spirit, typically a neutral grape spirit, to the fermentation cycle because by actively introducing a spirit, you render the yeast, the wine yeast, impotent and unable to react with the constituent parts of wine, the sugars predominantly. So it kind of traps the wine. And whenever you introduce the spirit, that has a very direct implication on the wine style. The earlier you add the spirit, typically the sweeter the fortified wine as the instance in port. And then with sherry, perhaps Fino and a little bit of Manzanilla, Montillado, you see the spirit added almost when the fermentation is completely halted. But again, they come in all shapes and sizes. And it's unfortunate that the conventional wisdom assigns them to sweet or the stickies category because my favorite fortified wines are the exact opposite. They're dry, they're really, really charismatic and wonderful with food.
Okay, so let's talk about the ones that are at the opposite end of what we think of as these stickies.
Mm-hmm.
Give me something that would be great in the summer, something bracing and with acid and clean, fresh.
Sure. One would be Manzanilla, which is one of the lightest styles of sherry made in Andalusia. I would say La Gitana by Hidalgo is one of my favorites. It's got a gypsy on the label. It's rather widely available, so I think that's a good one to recommend as it's both affordable, tangy, bright, and when served slightly chilled in the summer, I think is outstanding. For those who perhaps have a little bit of a resistance to accepting the true flavors of sherry, a nice light fortified wine also from France, from Normandy, by the DuPont family is called Pomo de Normandie, which is a estate blend of apples that are fermented. And then the spirit introduced in that fortified wine is Calvados, made of the apple there. So it's an apple brandy. And that is one of the most ethereal, light, almost like hushed wines I've ever had in my life. It nearly doesn't exist. It's so soft.
What would be the next level towards sweetness, but not
there yet?
Rancho Cucamonga, an AVA right out here in the San Bernardino County. The winery is Joseph Filippi, and they ferment a lot of co-ferment old vines. In the instance of one of my favorite fortified wines they make called Ruby Ruby, it's a wine made of Alicante Boucher, Zinfandel, Grenache, and a couple other field blends. But the point being, it's about 19.4% alcohol. There's a little bit of residual sugar in the wine. It's aged in redwood casks out there in the AVA of Rancho Cucamonga. Had the pleasure of tasting those wines on Valentine's Day, and I found it absolutely stunning what was being made here locally. And again, what we're looking at in that instance is more of the richer, kind of medium to dry, high acidity, caramel-colored, amber-hued. But again, you know, to avoid the discussion of basic wine flavor, which always assigns fig, prune, outside of that, I had all these vibrant flavors and textures in the wine, which made me really respect what they were doing in Cucamonga alongside of track housing in this totally bizarre wine-growing region, which used to be flourishing with wineries. I think there were 32,000 acres of vineyard at one point, and now there's 250.
Okay, so now take us to a sticky, but one that we haven't heard before.
This could be considered a sticky Madeira. Madeira is an island off the coast of Portugal and probably has one of the most prolific histories of fortified winemaking. For a number of centuries, it was the wine of king and king of wines, as was Tokaji of Hungary. You know, on the nose, you smell sweetness. And to a lot of people, that's immediately what scares them from drinking it. And it's that sweetness in the bottle, which aged over time, provides this really integrated and deep sense of flavor. It's like honey in a pharaoh's tomb. I mean, it's just really special. And sweet fortified wine is no more undrinkable than a candy bar is uneatable. So I don't understand why people seem to think that we can't drink fortified wines if they're sweet, when we have a tradition on a, you know, eating level which mimics that sweetness. You just have to find a time and place for it. You have to come bearing an open mind, a willingness to escape perhaps your expectation, but that's part of the fun. And I think the more we look for those experiences with wine, the better off we are.
Maxwell Lear is a wine steward here in LA, and his latest project is Wine to Vines. He also writes a monthly column about wine for Eater LA called Varying Hues. In celebration of summer, we'll be airing spirits and cocktail segments every week for the month of June. Tune in next week to learn all about vermouth, from the splash in your martini to sipping it on the rocks. Coming up next, the beauty of lard. You know it's great in pies, but cookies and cakes? Learn how to render your own and what to do with it in 1 minute right here on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at KCRW.com.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. There are a handful of food blogs out there that have made it big, really big. San Francisco has 101 Cookbooks. Seattle has Orangette. New York has Smitten Kitchen. And here in LA, we have our very own Joy the Baker. It's a homegrown, unpretentious look at every meal of the day, from breakfast to dinner to dessert, from the perspective of a woman who really loves to bake. Her new book is conveniently called Joy the Baker. Hi.
Hello.
I'm so happy to have Joy the Baker in front of me.
I am so happy to be here.
Tell us how you began baking, because it's kind of unusual.
Well, I started baking with my dad when I was a little girl, and my dad is not a professional baker at all. He's a dedicated, very enthusiastic home baker, and he worked the night shift my entire life. He worked at the post office downtown at Terminal Annex doing just grunty, hard labor, and he would come home at 4 a.m. and always want to bake something because that's what he actually loved to do. So my sister and I would naturally be sleeping, and he would come in our bedroom and wake us up and take us to the kitchen where we would bake something. And usually it was pies. My dad has a huge passion for pies. So we would sit on either end of the little kitchen table and help my dad roll out pie dough. And that's how I learned how to bake at 4 a.m. with my dad.
And I understand that you also had an aunt who was blind. And so that sort of gave you some insight into baking cues that didn't have to do with visual.
Yes. My aunt was blinded in her 30s, so she spent a lot of her life seeing and baking, and she had a great passion for that. And when she was blinded, she didn't want to give up baking, so she would figure out how to make recipes according to how they felt to her. And so she taught me a lot about how cake batter is supposed to feel before it goes into a pan and that sort of thing. Granted, her cakes did sometimes look a little bit like a blind person baked them. They looked a little crazy sometimes, but that's just real life.
So when did you decide that you really needed to publicly express this joy?
I decided in 2008 that when I was in between baking jobs that I didn't want to stop baking, and I just wanted an outlet for all of the stuff that I was making. And so I would take pictures of cakes that I had made or scones that I was excited about with my cell phone and put them up on this janky little blog called Joy the Baker with like a standard WordPress template. And I would just put my cell phone pictures up and talk about the recipe and talk about the silly things that were going on in my life at the time and hope that no one would read it.
I mean, it's sort of interesting to me, your blog. So much of your writing is, I feel like the baking reflects a mood. Could you talk a little bit about that, about how you approach deciding what it is you're going to make, how influenced you are by the time of day or a particular taste you have in your head, rather than being very recipe-driven, which I think home cooks tend to be?
Sure. I bake according to a mood I want to recreate or a person I want to think of. If I'm thinking of my aunt, for example, I'll instantly think of spice cakes and want to make some sort of spice variation, whether it's a cookie or a scone or some sort of cake. I'm, of course, because I live in California and Los Angeles, very seasonally driven as far as food goes. So I shop at the beautiful Santa Monica Farmers Market where I can get, you know, amazing summer fruits or winter nuts. And so that influences me as well. But it's all about a mood and what I can create inside of that.
Do you sometimes, when you're in a bad mood or a difficult mood or a tired mood, does that yield a certain type of baked good?
It usually yields disaster in my kitchen. I feel like if you don't approach ingredients with respect and patience, they can sort of smell your mood. And so oftentimes if I'm in a hurry or if I'm frustrated with something else, my recipes don't make it. Or I just turn to chocolate and just go that way.
So is chocolate your base level comfort?
Chocolate and peanut butter together.
Biscuits. What is your secret to a really great flaky biscuit?
I love biscuits. What I do is I like to mix fats in biscuits. So I always use a good unsalted butter and combine it with either lard, cold lard, or vegetable shortening. And I think mixing the fat in biscuits and incorporating them lightly with your fingers into the dry ingredients really makes good flaky biscuits.
And you do a lot with biscuits. Like you take biscuits and you'll tweak them. You seem to tweak biscuits constantly.
I do. I think you can add anything to biscuits, or you can add biscuits to anything. So recently I made caramelized mushroom and onion biscuits, which everyone was trying to convince me were scones, but clearly they were biscuits.
What is the difference in your mind?
Scones are often, in my mind, which may not be correct, sweet and for breakfast, and biscuits are anything for any time, always.
Did I see you make a cinnamon roll biscuit?
Oh, I did that. I took biscuit dough and instead of keeping it, you know, maybe an inch thick before I cut it, I rolled it out into a half inch thickness, and I spread it with melted butter, cinnamon, and sugar, and then I rolled it up like a cinnamon roll. So it's basically like a no yeast cinnamon roll.
Yum. Thank you, Joy.
Thank you.
That was Joy Wilson. Her new book is Joy the Baker, just like her blog. It's lovely, very easy to cook from. If you've made as much pie as I have, or as many biscuits as Joy has, you'll know that lard is not a scary word. It's actually quite a miracle. So when the book simply titled Lard came in the mail, I was intrigued and excited. Hank Will is the editor-in-chief of Grit, a magazine that's been celebrating rural America since 1882. He's here today to explain why lard has such a bad rap.
Post-World War II, you know, we had lots of production capability that was really no longer needed. We had a relatively good amount of agricultural crops because we had ramped up, so the corn production was substantially increased over the prior years. And so we really wound up not needing to have animal lubricants anymore. And a company that made a fairly useful industrial lubricant, which we now know as Crisco, saw an opportunity to sort of reposition its product as a healthy vegetable-based food product. So if you think about it, you know, Crisco is highly hydrogenated, or it used to be anyway. I'm not sure what the recipe is today. Largely vegetable oil that's been basically made rancid through heat and oxidation, and then it's been deodorized and you name it, bleached to get that product that you have that doesn't spoil. And strangely enough, that my hogs won't even touch.
They turn their nose up at Crisco.
Literally.
Can we talk a little bit about the sort of profile, the scientific profile of lard versus butter, for example? People tend to think of it as such an unhealthy fat. Is it really unhealthy?
No, it's really not. There was this lipid hypothesis that was put forth in the late 50s and was, you know, fairly well adopted and backed by the AMA in the early 60s, that basically said that fat in equals fat on, cholesterol consumed equals cholesterol in your bloodstream. And so I think we just had this sort of this wave of public and professional adoption without really exploring the details. So if you take a look at lard and butter have a fairly similar profile, pretty high in vitamins. Lard actually has quite a bit less saturated fat than butter. And the saturated fats, the thing that I should say about the saturated fat is that part of the reason why saturated fats were vilified is that saturation of the fat molecules actually makes them have a lower melting point. So they're more likely to be solid at room temperature or at warmer temperatures, if that makes sense. So the idea was that, oh, okay, if they're going to be solid at, you know, if saturated fats are more solid on the kitchen table, then it must stand to reason that they're going to solidify in our arteries or be more likely to solidify in our arteries and therefore block them.
So let's get to the deliciousness of the whole thing. Describe the differences between the two major types of lard.
The sort of traditional lard is that which we would call these days artisanal or something like that. And this would be lard that would be rendered from the fat that surrounds kind of the kidney area and maybe up into the back fat, a little bit of the pig. The kidney fat is typically called leaf fat, and it's just really nice, fairly pure. It's not filled with very much connective tissue, so not much protein in it. And basically the rendering process takes that material, which is sort of semi-solid in a lard pig anyway, at room temperature. You take that and you roast it very slowly in the oven in a shallow pan, say at 225 or so. And it liquefies the fat molecules and they drain basically from the connective tissue, the protein that's still there. What you'll wind up with is something that's beautifully white that will last for, you know, months in the freezer anyway, and just as a delightful shortening. Folks that render it a little bit harder, and that's what I would call raising the temperature or cooking it a little bit harder so that you can get cracklings. The remaining connective tissue, those proteins are what basically forms the cracklings, which at home we actually feed those things to the chickens because we don't make cracklings. But if you do make cracklings, then what you wind up with is a nice shortening that's got a little bit of flavor in it, a little bit more flavor, and may in fact take on a little bit of a yellowish tint to it. Unfortunately, the commercial lard that's currently available, it's basically all the fat scraps that remain after an animal is cut into the box-sized pieces that get shipped all over the world. And those things are stored up and then they're heated in huge vats to very high temperatures, and the fat's drained off, and it already comes off slightly rancid. And when I say rancid, really in fat chemistry, being rancid means being slightly oxidized. It comes with the way to say it would be kind of a tainted smell and flavor. It's often gray. It doesn't look very appealing, and frankly, it's not very appetizing. And so it goes through a series of deodorizing and bleaching processes to, make it even remotely palatable. And then it gets chemically modified through a process called hydrogenation to actually make it harder at room temperature than it would normally be.
Now, you said the word lard pig before. Are there different kinds of pigs that are just used to get lard?
Yeah, in the olden days, before the age of petroleum, farmers could make much more money basically marketing the fat that their hogs produced instead of the flesh, instead of the meat. If you think about it, early oil wells were the machinery to drill those was lubricated with lard. In the modern age, there really is only one pig, and it's the lean, the other white meat sort of factory pig, except for a number of folks that throughout the years have kept these sort of older breeds alive. And there are really kind of three kinds of pigs, I suppose, nowadays that you can find. There are lard pigs, then there are bacon pigs, and then, of course, there's the meat hog, which is really what we have in most of the modern farms today.
Let's talk about using lard to cook with. I mentioned at the beginning that I use it in my pie dough, which is fantastic, and I think that's what most people think of when they think about using lard. They think of using it in pastry. What other kind of baked goods, though, are delicious with lard that we've probably never thought of?
You can make some really delicious cake and raised donuts using lard actually as the cooking medium, and maybe that doesn't exactly count. You can use lard in cakes and brownies, you name it.
Also, there are so many cookie recipes, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but it never occurred to me to make a cookie with lard.
Well, that's a really interesting observation. I was probably more surprised about using lard to make cookies than I was about using something like bacon fat, bacon drippings to make cookies, strictly because my mother used to make ginger snaps. And one of her key ingredients in there was, came out of the can on the side of the stove that the bacon drippings went into. So it turns out that I'd been eating lard-laced cookies as a youngster and that I didn't even really know it.
Well, Hank, thank you so much. It's a really, really interesting book. And I think a lot of people out there will finally be moved to render their own.
I certainly hope so, and thanks so much.
That was Hank Will, editor-in-chief of Grit magazine. The book Lard is a communal effort from Grit and a must-read for any curious cook. You can see my own method for rendering leaf lard, including pictures, on the Good Food blog. What do you use lard for? Share your recipes and your ideas on my Facebook page. I would really love to see them. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and join the conversation. Coming up, where to find the best cheap eats in LA. That's in 30 seconds, right here on Good Food.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Joining me now is Los Angeles Magazine's Dine editor, Leslie Barger Suter. Leslie recently won a James Beard Award for her fabulous breakfast roundup, and today she's joining us with more delicious recommendations, this time for cheap eats in and around L.A. Hi, Leslie.
Hello.
So cheap eats, is that something that is hard to find?
Certainly not, and now more than ever. In fact, even what we think of as being cheap has sort of changed definitions. I think cheap, you know, is a dollar amount, but it's also sort of an aesthetic. It's, you know, when you think cheap, just because you can get a pizza for, you know, $13 doesn't necessarily make it cheap. So we, as a magazine, actually kind of had to redefine our parameters of what cheap means. And it's more than a dollar amount. It's more than the price tag. It's sort of an aesthetic. It's a genre. But it spans ethnicities. It spans neighborhoods, especially in LA. And in general, our overall dining style is moving toward cheap.
So give me the sort of parameters that you created for this new batch of cheap eats.
Sure. Well, as much as I say there's no dollar amount, we had a dollar amount just to kind of start things off. And to allow for a good variety, we said that your total bill leaving full from a restaurant as an individual should be under $15. Also, we had to not have written about it before in our previous issue. There were ones we missed last time, and then there's just been so many new places. There's been such a boom because of the economy in not only small ethnic places that are opening up, but also some fine dining chefs that are sort of moving into the cheap realm as well.
So let's start with the place that gets the double wide spread at the very beginning.
Because it just looks so good.
Oh, my gosh.
We featured as the most beautiful pile of food, Blood Zoe's, which is a barbecue place, Texas-style barbecue. And Kevin Blood Zoe is the guy. They opened the place a few years ago. They'd been doing sort of barbecue catering for a long time, and that now they opened up a place, I think it's Compton?
Yeah, it is in Compton.
That they have where it's a little walk-up stand. He's out there sort of fueling the smoker 24 hours a day, day and night. And then you come in there, you can get ribs, brisket. But I think some of their surprise hits are the sides. They're sort of fluorescent yellow macaroni and cheese is in some oddly sort of alien but soulful way incredibly satisfying.
So why don't you take us through a few of the sandwich places that you have on this list? Because you have a couple.
We do. There was a new entry into the sandwich game this year. You might have talked about Ink Sack, which is Michael Voltaggio, who does the fancy ink restaurant next door. And then he's got these little sandwiches that, you know, people complain a bit because his gourmet sandwiches are small, but they're also like $5. So you can get two of them and you're still eating two different examples of what Michael Voltaggio does best, which is layering flavors and elements and textures. They've got a fried chicken one that's just really good. I think he started doing pastrami recently. He changes it up a lot. There's a banh mi, and it's always got a really nice mesh of texture, temperature, flavor, heat, spice, all of that all together. So those are great sandwiches. There's a new Philly cheesesteak place in town for Philly purists. They even have tasty cakes. It's called Booze Philly, which is in sort of that border between Silver Lake and Los Feliz. The bread is Amoroso's, which for people who, you know.
That is the bread.
That is the bread you must have. The beef, Dietz and Watson. And the cheese, they've got your provolone, they've got your whiz, which is sort of an American, back to yellow cheese again. It shows up many times on this cheap eats list, this sort of fluorescent yellow alien cheese. But this place, having gone with people who are from Philadelphia, they all leave satisfied, and they kind of have this feeling of, finally, there's a real Philly cheesesteak place. So that place is great.
Okay, now let's veer away from the sandwich just a little bit.
Okay.
And focus on ethnic places.
Yes. So, I'm going to go out on a limb and say Bebas. I'm sorry, they didn't say their name when you walk in. Now, there are not many Bolivian restaurants in Los Angeles. Some say there may be only this one, which is in Van Nuys, which is where so many great things of food is. They've got this thing called the salteñas, which are these sort of meat pies. They're sweet, they're savory. Now, it sounds like kind of a weird combo, but they'll do things like eggs, hard-boiled egg, but then they'll have raisins in there, too. And the raisins act more like a rich umaminess more than they're just sweet. They're sort of like empanadas. There's tons of spices, and it's a place to explore the cuisine of Bolivia, which honestly was new to me and is pretty new to Los Angeles. So what's not new to me is Hawaiian food. Brothers, they love lots of food. If that plate is not overflowing, if that plate doesn't look like it could last you four meals, the Hawaiian community will say that it is a ripoff. Brothers is in Gardena. They do really great, authentic Hawaiian food. They do lau lau, which is really a great Hawaiian staple. But, of course, the loco moco, which is that weird sort of hybrid with there's gravy and, like, a hamburger patty and an egg. And but they also do great Hawaiian plate lunches, you know, where you've got the macaroni salad and then you've got pork. And it's all sort of sweet and spicy and savory. And, again, it's a weird mix between sort of Asian and, like, picnic American food that Hawaiians do so well that Brothers is great. It's one of our favorite Hawaiian spots.
Okay, so we've been talking so much about meat. What about the seafood area?
Seafood and cheap sometimes sounds like a challenge because you want to have fresh seafood. You don't want it to be frozen seafood. Your solution, Fisherman's Outlet. So it's a fried sort of seafood counter. So think, you know, you're sitting on the pier, though you're not, you're in downtown LA, and you've got fried shrimp or grilled shrimp, and you've got all various types of fish. You can get charbroiled or fried or battered or not. And while you're waiting in this line with 10,000 people and you're approaching this counter and there are men up there, they're screaming in Spanish and English orders back and forth, and you have all this pressure because by the time you get to the front, you better know which of their 30 kinds of fish you want, and do you want it on french fries or rice, and then do you want it with coleslaw or do you want it cornmeal battered? There's just 8,000 different varieties of seafood, and they're all really, really fresh. The reason why this is situated there is because that's where a lot of the fish markets are, so it's not like they're trucking it any farther than the rest of your food would go.
So we can't talk about cheap eats and not talk about pizza. It sort of seems to be a moment of pizza flowering, if you will.
The pizza is rising. I'm trying to come up with a better pizza pun than this. There's got to be one out there. I think I used them all up in the issue. Yes, we are having a pizza renaissance. So we had a bunch. We wanted to point out some of our favorites. Pizza Nista, downtown, which is a new one. It's a good, this is, you know, thin crust New York style, a la Bleecker Street style pizza. Then you've also got Two Boots, which comes from New York. They had a branch in Echo Park. They just opened one downtown. They do weird topping pizzas with crazy pop culture-y names. The Bayou Beast is the one we shot, which is the one they're kind of famous for. It's got shrimp and andouille sausage. It's sort of a New Orleans-inspired one. And then, of course, we shot 800 Degrees because you can build your own pizza there for $5. To get a great Neapolitan pizza for $5 is wonderful.
Thank you so much, Leslie. This is, I think I see another award in the offing here.
Oh, shucks. Don't jinx it.
That was Leslie Barger-Suter. She is Dine Editor for Los Angeles Magazine, and we've been picking and choosing through the 101 Cheap Eats issue. It's at your newsstand now, so go pick it up while you can still have a real copy in your hands to keep in your car. Next Sunday, June 10th, I'll be a judge at Taste of the Nation's Cook-Off. Tickets are still available for the full day of food and drink. And remember that all proceeds benefit local charities and Share Our Strengths mission to end childhood hunger in the U.S. For details on how to buy tickets, go to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia is our segment producer, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. And a special thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.